Welcome to the Omfer podcast.
Welcome everyone. In today's podcast, we will be talking about financial stability, stress tests by central banks, and what the future for fiscal monetary interaction will be in 2021. So we're very pleased to have with us today Ludger Schuknecht, former chief economist of the German Finance Ministry and also deputy secretary general at the OECD. He's also the author of several books on public spending reform, public policy, and numerous other topics. Today, he will present to all of our listeners his latest book on public spending and the role of the state, history, performance, risk, and remedies. Ludger has also been employing his extensive experience in international economic policy and decision-making to promote the OECD efforts while he was at the OECD on sustainable development, growth, and better policies for better lives. He previously also at the German Finance Ministry held the position of chief economist, and he has had a long career in international organizations, and other assignments included senior advisor at the ECB, the European Central Bank, where he worked on fiscal policies, monetary policy decision making, and European policy coordination, the World Trade Organization, and the International Monetary Fund. We also have with us today Dimitri Demekas, a visiting senior fellow at the Institute of Global Affairs at the London School of Economics. He's also a special advisor to the Bank of England and a consultant to the International Finance Corporation, the IFC, on capital markets issues. Dimitri was also a senior advisor to the Saudi presidency of the G20 during 2020 and has consulted with a number of international organizations. Prior to that, he had a 30-year career at the IMF, where he left in 2017 as assistant director at the Monetary and Capital Markets Department. He led the fund's work on financial stability analytics and stress tests and managed the IMF's financial sector assessment program during the decade following the global financial crisis. And his views today in our discussion are his own and do not represent the Bank of England or the IMF. Thank you both very much for joining us today. Looking forward to this discussion. So, we've seen in 2020 quite a lot of governments increasing public spending and public borrowing. We've seen record levels of public borrowing, even from countries like Germany, for example, that have traditionally not engaged in issuance of debt. We've seen debt calendars be very crowded in the advanced economies, and also the European Union, the European Commission setting its recovery fund and plans for debt issuance at the European level. How do you think this pandemic-induced levels of borrowing, the rise in public spending, is affecting financial stability across Europe in 2020 and looking beyond this year? Do you think there are some long-term things that we should be concerned about when it comes to financial stability and the rise in public spending? Perhaps to you, Ludger, first, and then Dimitri, you can add your views as well.
Thank you, Demi. You're rightly observing that the fiscal policies have been on a very, very expansionary course. But I should say that in this pandemic phase, which we are still in, this has been very important to stabilize our economies together with the monetary support provided by central banks. So I think the quick and timely action by governments was very welcome. And given that private demand retreated in this phase, I think it has helped maintain incomes and jobs and companies in the hope that after the pandemic is over, we can more quickly and easily go back to normal without scarring. But at the same time, you are right by pointing out that, you know, the obligations that governments have taken on board have increased enormously public spending ratios by about 10% of GDP. The average for advanced countries is now almost 50%. France is reaching 63% of GDP. Public debt has been going up in 2020 by about 20% of GDP, and in the G7 countries is now near 140% of GDP, which is just like after World War II. And deficits are in many countries in double-digit territory deficit ratios. So this will be a big challenge in the long run and in the medium run already.
So if I get it right, what you're saying is that it was the right thing to do. We needed to have these high levels of public spending to contain the crisis that is in front of us. But at the same time, this means that there are challenges for the future. So it was the right approach, but we still have to think about what we're going to do with it.
Exactly.
Thank you. Thank you, Ludger. And Dimitri, what do you think about this? Ludger also mentioned the central banks and how they've also worked in this pandemic, before the pandemic, we've heard a lot about central banks being the only game in town. Now they also had to step up at the same time as fiscal policy for the first time, really moving as much as they perhaps had wanted. But some of the policymakers that we've spoken to at OMFIF are also saying that if we hadn't taken those measures, then the financial stability risks would be even higher. We recognize that there are some financial stability risks because of the measures we have taken, but we can't really know the counterfactual. What is your view about this and about the financial stability outlook in 2021?
So I think if we want to discuss the financial stability implications of the experience in 2020, it's useful to distinguish between two different channels through which the shock we are experiencing still can impact financial stability. The first round economic impact of the pandemic itself and the second round effects of the policy responses from lockdowns to public spending and borrowing and central bank action. Now, when I say first and second round, I don't mean to suggest that first we will see one and then the other. The distinction is not about the sequence in which each effect will manifest itself, but it is about the channels through which each of them could affect financial stability and probably also the duration of each effect. With a little luck, if economies start to recover the second half of this year, we will be done with the first round effects, but the second round effects will be with us for a while. So what are these effects and their channels? As regards the first round effect, there is a debate as to whether we should think about this as a supply shock or a demand shock, which I personally don't find very illuminating. But from the point of view of financial stability, this is the classic real sector / macro shock modeled in supervisory stress tests. It affects banks through credit losses, credit risk, market risk, and of course also liquidity risk if funding sources dry out. So far, so straightforward. The second round effects are a different story. Since they reflect the effects of the policy responses to the pandemic, they're obviously different from country to country, but I would say there are two channels through which these second round effects could affect financial stability. First, the deterioration in public balance sheets as a result of measures to support aggregate demand, as Rutger mentioned. And in many economies that already had high public debt levels, this could raise questions of sustainability that could spill over to the financial sector. And in the EU, the European Central Bank in its latest financial stability report already warned about the reemergence of the sovereign bank nexus. And the second channel for the second round effects is, of course, the implications of monetary policy, particularly the unprecedentedly low level of interest rates and the prolongation of low interest rates, which markets now expect will last perhaps for several years. This, of course, fuels the search for yield, higher risk-taking, the compression of risk premium, and asset price overvaluation. Now, none of these things are in and of themselves events of financial instability, but the sudden unwinding of any of these factors could amplify shocks and undermine financial stability.
Let's talk a little bit more about this channel and monetary policy in particular, because there is this debate of should central banks start unwinding their expansionary policies in 2021? How soon, how quickly should they do it? As you said, Dimitri, there is a sense of financial markets getting used to a lot of this support. And so far, we have managed to avoid what has been a real economy shock, as you described it as well, spilling over to the financial sector. So financial markets have been largely shielded by the shock to the real economy. This has been to a large part thanks to the efforts of central banks in terms of the measures that they've put in place. But we cannot indefinitely have this lack of alignment between what the real economy is doing and what financial markets are doing. So which one will adjust first to meet the other? And how can the path towards normalization for central banks look if we are looking at 2021? Ludger, do you have any thoughts about this specifically on the ECB? What do you see the risks to be to exiting too quickly, or how soon should they do it?
I would like to start with the fiscal side, because I think unlike in the global financial crisis, where much of the response came from central banks, we now have a stronger response from the fiscal side. And as Dimitri was saying, you know, there's a sustainability risk that could arise from the increase in spending, in deficits, and in debt. just to give you a flavor, I mean, you know, compare the 60 or more percent of GDP spending in some of the countries. This is much more than any industrial countries has ever raised in revenue. So we have here an issue which starts on the spending side, feeds into deficits, and then into debt. And Dimitri rightly stressed that, you know, if this is not addressed at some point, it could re-raise the question of the sustainability in a number of European countries, which then would feed into the question of, you know, what are financial markets going to do? Are they going to charge a higher spread? Are these countries going to maintain access to markets? And then is the ECB going to bail them implicitly out under the label of monetary policies, of course, but I mean, you know, through more asset purchase programs, etc. So the fiscal side is really important here. And here another complication is that we don't know when the recovery is going to take off. The recovery will take off. People have saved a lot of money, which, you know, they'll want to spend. And then the question, you know, will come, should fiscal policy support be withdrawn, and can that kind of link up to re-establishing credibility on the fiscal side? And I think this is the first challenge of governments, kind of waiting until the recovery is coming, not withdrawing support too early, but at the same time, not waiting too long, you know, then maybe contributing to overheating, but worsening the sustainability concern. So I think the policy space in which the central bank, the European Central Bank, but frankly also the UK and the US will find themselves depends very much on the fiscal environment they're going to be in.
When you think about debt sustainability, what are the kind of key things that you think we should be looking at? Is it the kind of debt to GDP ratio, which is the main thing that we look at? There's also ways to look at it through the payment terms, the interest rates, the maturities. It's a very kind of complicated set of indicators that one can look at. For you, when you think about Europe and you talk a lot about debt sustainability, how do you look at these things together?
I think the three indicators I mentioned, spending, deficits, and debt, are the three indicators to look at. And while, you know, debt service is not very high in a low interest environment, it can shoot up very suddenly when markets lose trust. So, of course, spreads then is the fourth variable that one should look at. The three first ones are, so to speak, preventive, and the fourth one is then a reactive variable. And there is no number, magic number, that tells you, you know, when deficits or spending or debt is not sustainable. We don't know that. It depends on the medium-term plans this is embedded in. A country can have a higher deficit if it has a credible medium-term plan to get out of it. A country can have a higher spending ratio if it has a good control of public finances that will credibly bring it down again, and the same with public debt. So the confidence that markets will have in governments will depend not just on the numbers, but also on the policy environment and the policy path this is linked to. And I think that is really a big challenge for the governments going forward, where they will be drawn between, on the one hand, you know, keeping support to sustain the recovery, and on the other hand, not missing the boat, not getting behind the curve on the, so to speak, the market trust, which then could undermine or could impact on central banks, where we admittedly have this concern that, you know, if fiscal credibility is not maintained, this could infringe on central bank credibility, where at some point central banks may want to raise rates, may want to withdraw their non-standard measures, their asset purchases. But, you know, if the fiscal environment is not credible, then they may anywhere, central banks anywhere, may find themselves in a pickle about whether they can actually do it without causing problems in either on the kind of inflation, financial stability side, or on the fiscal side.
Yes, that is, of course, more of a political issue for central banks if they're causing problems on the fiscal side. For now, a lot of these institutions are politically independent in the way they are set up, but there have been some concerns raised by some central bankers about fiscal dominance, which is one of the risks that you were perhaps describing here, and that they may have to maintain accommodative monetary policy to support the rise in public spending and rise in public debt. What do you think about that, Dimitri? Do you think, and also on the issues that Ludger raised about fiscal policy going forward, but also on central banks, do you think there are some risks to their independence perhaps, or risks to fiscal dominance of fiscal dominance from the way they've responded to the crisis so far?
I think Ludger framed the issues well, and he responded like the two-handed economist. And I am an economist as well, so I don't have much to add to this. The measures that have been taken so far, the extraordinary fiscal and monetary policy support measures, were necessary. And indeed, we saw in recent months most governments extended both the duration and the reach of these measures. So at the same time, on the other hand, the policymakers need to be aware of the risks these measures create for financial stability down the line. And does not mean that they have to stop these measures or reverse them as quickly as possible. But it does mean that they should try to make their financial sectors as resilient as possible to deal with the potential repercussions if they materialize.
And following up on that and the resilience of the financial sector, you mentioned in your opening remarks that what we've seen is a classic real shock that is modeled in the supervisory stress test. How well do you think the stresses by the European Banking Authority, the ECB, the Bank of England in the banking sector in the euro area and also in the UK have been in anticipating these kinds of shocks?
Well, this is a very interesting question and one that I think central banks will be asking themselves once this emergency is over. If you look at the macro scenarios in the stress tests by the Bank of England and the EU-wide stresses by the European Banking Authority, the EBA, for the last 2 or 3 years, you will see that the magnitude of the actual shock in 2020 was much greater than what these tests had anticipated. Looking at the numbers, the 2019 annual cyclical stress test of the Bank of England was predicated on the assumption of a 4.7% decline in UK GDP and a 2.6% decline in world GDP. The 2018 annual cyclical scenario of the bank was of a similar magnitude. But in the event, the latest projections, and these come from the November Monetary Policy Committee report, are for a decline of 11% of UK GDP in 2020 and over 5% of world GDP. And this is more than double the shock assumed in the 2019 and 2018 stress tests of the bank. In the EU, the 2018 EU-wide stress test of the EBA, there was no solvency stress in 2019, assumed a decline in EU GDP of 1.2% in the first year of the shock and 2.2% in the second year with a recovery in the third. But again, in the event, according to the EU's latest autumn forecast, the projected decline in EU GDP in 2020 was 7.5%. Again, more than double the cumulative over 2 years shock assumed in the 2018 stress test. And I should add here that according to the EBA, the 2018 stress test scenario was the most severe of all previous EU-wide stress tests. Now, to be sure, there are several other variables that go into the determining the severity of a stress test scenario, not just real GDP growth. But in a typical macro shock, real GDP growth is the most important. And it seems that our most severe but plausible, to use the Basel Committee terminology, stress test scenarios were dwarfed by the actual real life shock in 2020. And mind you, this is not the first time this happens. Back in 2009, when I was still at the IMF, I led an evaluation of stress tests undertaken by central banks and supervisory agencies and by the IMF itself before the global financial crisis. And what we found was that the stress test scenarios had generally underestimated the shock of 2008-2009. So it seems that supervisors in their supervisory stress tests failed to anticipate the magnitude of real-life shocks. But fortunately, how well the financial sectors are prepared to deal with the shocks does not depend only on the severity of stress test scenarios. And in contrast to what happened in the global financial crisis, financial sectors in advanced economies today, at least in advanced economies, are much more resilient to shocks. And the main factors behind this, of course, are the post-crisis reforms. First and foremost, higher capital buffers, but also better resolution regimes and stronger and more intrusive supervision.
I would agree with this very much. Dimitri, I think you point out it's a very important challenge for the supervisors. If I may add one that links up with public finances again. I don't recall how the stress tests for government debt were, but and in this corona crisis now, we haven't had major shocks to the financing conditions of governments. But we know that, you know, banks hold, at least in some countries, enormous amounts of government debt on their balance sheets. And if you do get into a situation where spreads rise strongly, then, you know, depending on how you treat it from the supervisory perspective, whether you forbear or not, you could have major problems for bank balance sheets coming from that angle. And that, I think, has two implications. One is the supervisor should not neglect this dimension, also with a view to warning governments, you know, what about this feedback loop that is still in place, especially through this channel, even though we have now got, you know, bank resolution fund and ESM and all these mechanisms to deal with banks that get into trouble. But the trouble is potentially still there. And that is very important. Therefore, it is very important that also on the fiscal side, we maintain this sustainability-oriented medium-term policy orientation by governments, where governments are tempted right now through both kind of academic postulations that more debt doesn't matter, and the fact that in this crisis we basically haven't seen much of this link from government debt and deficits to spreads and to the financial sector. But I think this is both a state contingent developments which may not happen in the future. In the future, we may again see more of this, and we may see more of the government problems spilling over into the financial sector and then spilling back to government if the financial sector gets into difficulties. So I think what you are saying, Dimitri, speaks for an appropriately robust stress testing of government debt on bank balance sheets.
Thanks, Ludger. So apart from being two-handed, the economists are also optimistic or perhaps complacent, is one what one may conclude from what you've been saying about the way the stresses have been set, both for financial markets and for governments. But of course, on what you're saying now, Ludger, about the perhaps complacency and what may happen in the future, it's also what would happen if there wasn't that rise in public debt now. So my question to you would be, do you see this as a parenthesis, as an extraordinary measure to respond to this extraordinary crisis that we're seeing now with coronavirus? Or do you see the changes that we're seeing in Europe in terms of the ability to issue debt at the Commission level and also the recovery fund as something that may perhaps be longer lasting in the euro area and in the European Union in terms of how the architecture of the EMU is? Do you see a return to normalization, to Maastricht becoming even more binding and important in the future? How do you see this happening?
I do think that, you know, what we all seem to have stressed in the beginning, that we need sustainable public finances, that remains important. And you cannot simply kind of claim there is no problem because interest rates are currently zero. The second thing is, you know, how do you finance the debt? In what kind of constellation? How do you balance solidarity with, so to speak, conditionality and stringency? I mean, Maastricht is, in that sense, is over. You know, and there will be no going back to a Maastricht world where every country is responsible for its own things. And that, you know, that was a deliberate decision by all European governments to change that and to have this one-off debt issuance in the corona crisis. At least it is legally declared to be one-off. And in Germany, this is important for constitutional reasons. I think it is a very strong signal that in such a difficult time, countries in difficulty are not left alone. But it bears the risk that, in a way, the complementary measures needed to strengthen growth and to strengthen sustainability in the medium to long run beyond that kind of common debt, you know, may not be taken as seriously in all countries as they should be. And that could have fiscal and economic repercussions in the sense that countries may get into trouble, and then political repercussions in the sense that, you know, in some countries people may say, look, I mean, you know, we have been solidaric, we've been supporting countries financially, and then they didn't deliver on the reforms, and now they're in trouble again, and why should we pay again? This will be a never-ending story. So in that sense, there is a great responsibility for everybody, and not just Southern European countries, for everybody, including Germany. I really must emphasize here that the necessary reform measures need to be taken to keep public finance sustainable in all countries and in the euro area, because we mustn't overburden our public finances, our economies, our politics neither. You know, people have shown they are willing to be solidaric, but we must also give them a sense that this is a process that where everybody does their part of the work, including, as I would like to emphasize again, including the rich countries, including the northern countries, not just the southern countries.
Thank you, Lütker. And yes, thanks for raising also the point about the politics and the political tolerance for what the implications of these measures may be. We saw that very clearly in the euro area sovereign debt crisis of the past decade. Of course, it's also politics are also formed, the opinions of the public are also formed by the way that policymakers such as yourselves in your previous capacities or in your interactions with these institutions are able to successfully communicate and explain the rationale behind these policies. And that's something that there needs to be a lot of work on in Europe and elsewhere. We're seeing that that's more of a political and sociological discussion, perhaps. But Dimitri, let me turn to you now. We've spoken about Europe, about the financial stability outlook for Europe and the reforms that were made. In the UK, we also have the additional headache, perhaps, or opportunity, as and depending on your point of view, of Brexit. How do you see that affecting the financial stability issues in the UK and in Europe as well, given its close connections with London as a financial and economic capital?
So the financial stability risks in the EU and the UK are broadly similar, but there are some important differences between the financial sectors in the two. What we have seen in the UK is massive government response that has eased the pain on households and corporates. In fact, the ratio of over-indebted households actually declined in 2020, and corporate insolvencies have, at least so far, remained subdued. And this was a combined effect of tax and employment-related measures like the job retention scheme, the kickstart scheme, and others, and the economic stimulus measures like the coronavirus business interruption loan schemes, what two schemes, one for large and one for small companies. In addition, and this is very important, British companies were able to raise finance to meet their liquidity needs from non-bank sources. Non-bank lending to companies is now about half of the total, and that includes SMEs. And the combination of these two factors has limited credit risk for banks, which were actually able to improve, albeit marginally, their capital positions in 2020. British banks today have core equity tier 1 capital at 15.8% at the end of September, and that comes from the latest financial stability report, which is three times the level at the beginning of the global financial crisis. So in the UK, I think the key risks are in the non-bank financial sector. Given the compressed corporate bond spreads, the elevated level of fallen angels, you know, the bonds that have lost investment status, and the underpricing of risk, the probability of market volatility or sudden price reversals remains high. Now, we should remember that market stability and financial stability are different things. So market volatility would not necessarily translate into financial instability. But of course, it may amplify shocks and increase risks. And needless to say, if infections take a turn for the worse and the economic recovery is delayed, we could have a renewed wave of first round effects that could aggravate the outlook further. Now, in the EU, on the other hand, the situation is more complex. There was fiscal support by all individual governments and the ECB measures, notably the Pandemic Emergency Asset Purchase Program, the PEP, as well as the higher limits for the regular asset purchase program. And these have mitigated the impact of the pandemic on the real sector. But the picture is highly uneven because individual governments differ in their fiscal space and in their implementation capacity. There have been some EU-wide initiatives, such as SURE, the support to mitigate unemployment risks in an emergency. But so far, only about 100 billion were approved under this program and about 50 disbursed. There is an ESM credit line, but that's unlikely to be used because of the stigma. And there's, of course, the Next Generation EU initiative, which met with enthusiastic headlines when it was announced. But I think there are still very significant political and technical details to be ironed out about the Next Generation EU initiative. And as the ECB put it very diplomatically in their latest financial stability report, the impact of the Next Generation EU will depend on its timely operationalization and effective use, end quote. In any event, I think a total amount of 5.5% of GDP over 6 years is just too little to make a difference. Now, turning to the financial sector, there are two key challenges in the EU. The first is the reemergence, according to the ECB, of the sovereign bank nexus that bedeviled the financial sectors in the euro area debt crisis, which Ludger already mentioned. And second, we must remember, EU financial sectors are still bank-dominated. EU-based corporates were able to raise non-bank finance. Their ratio is about 20% of total in the EU, as opposed to 50% in the UK. And the combination of these two factors puts a lot of pressure on EU banks, which is where I think the key risks are in the EU. And EU banks in many countries already had weak balance sheets and low provisioning levels, lower than US and UK banks and lower than in previous crises. And although capital is currently adequate, capital generation capacity is very low. Profitability is very low. It declined in Q3 and according to the ECB is likely to be revised downwards even further. So although common equity tier 1 ratios are adequate, they are projected to fall according to the ECB, and even in the baseline ECB projection and in the adverse ECB projection of prolonged pandemic impact, core equity tier 1 ratios could fall by another 20%. So this is a huge potential financial stability risk and could have real sector implications if banks, as a result of that, tighten credit standards. And at the same time, of course, second round effects in financial markets are also evident with increased risk taking, etc. But as in the UK, this would not necessarily threaten financial stability, but it might amplify shocks.
Thank you, Dimitri. And putting there a lot of issues on the structure of the European financial sector. As you said, it's a very bank-like region. There is a lot of effort on the capital markets union. That's something perhaps for the longer term. But also you made some comments about perhaps we can term the financial safety net in Europe and what measures there are in place, some of the precautionary credit lines that the ESM has, for example. You mentioned the stigma effect. It, of course, bears the question, if we are not going to use such a facility now in the biggest crisis we've seen, what's the point of having it anyway? So how can we move beyond these concerns about such measures and how we can strengthen the financial safety net? And turning to you, Ludger, now as well, because you were saying before, both of you, about the perhaps inadequate planning for financial markets in terms of the stresses or for governments as well. There is the IMF, for example, has the Article 4 consultations where it looks at the macro environment in various countries. We are seeing some regulators trying to put in place even more kinds of stress tests. The Bank of England and others are working on climate stresses, for example. We haven't mentioned the word climate so far in our podcast, but that's also a big concern for central banks when it comes to financial instability and risks stemming from other kinds of shocks that we may see in the future. You said how the shock that we're seeing now was not really part of the models before, or the magnitude of what we're seeing now, and that may be a lesson to be learned for the kind of shocks that we may see in the future, including from climate change. So how do you, Ludger, see these changes that perhaps policymakers should be thinking about and regulators and supervisors in the way that they assess these risks, and also on the financial safety net comments that Dimitri was making just now?
Now let me make two comments. The first one on Brexit. Here, I think what is also very important is that this will be handled constructively. I mean, I'm always telling my European colleagues that, you know, if we want to export German cars and French wine to the UK, we give them something to make money with to buy that. So, I mean, I would hope that openness of the financial market profiting from London and the UK as a financial center that we will not score the own goal of protectionism in this area. And that, you know, we will maintain good cooperation and at the same time some healthy competition that keeps both the UK and, you know, the EU fit for the future, because the real challenges and the kind of countries that are, while we are looking inward, you know, around us, countries are actually progressing quite fast, and sometimes we are too centered on ourselves. The second point is exactly, you know, related to the kind of financial stability risk we've been discussing, the imbalances in the financial sector coupled with, you know, major asset price valuations, if not bubbles, that are emerging, the climate challenge, I mean, the aging challenge we haven't mentioned. It underpins my point that in order to be resilient for the future, we should not, you know, no company would do this. We should not kind of go to the utmost limit of indebtedness that is possible by today's standards, but we should see resilience also as kind of from a risk management perspective. What challenges are there in the future from governments? And does this not mean that in our spending, our deficits, our debt choices, we should take into account that there may be more to come, that this is not the end of it? And my book, Public Spending and the Role of the State, makes a lot of points about this, you know, describing how spending has evolved, what money is spent on, and what risks we still have, including from the financial sector, from aging, from climate. And that, to my mind, brings us back, perhaps, if you allow me, to this question also of Maastricht. I mean, I said Maastricht will not come back the way it was in 1992 or 93. But we will need something to anchor expectations about public finances and related policies that maintain stability, just like in the financial sphere. We'll need it in the fiscal sphere. And that will require some kind of framework of fiscal rules, both from the macro side as well as from the budgeting side. And, you know, the stability and growth pact of the EU is far from perfect. But I think if it is implemented, it provides a framework with a lot of flexibility that at the same time could promote this stability and also help underpin financial stability by kind of, you know, keeping that flank, you know, free and preventing conflicts from the fiscal flank spilling over into the financial one. If I may, I mean, this is really why I think efficient, contained public spending, good government is the key to master the fiscal challenges of the future and thereby also support financial and macro stability.
I wanted to go back and amplify a point made by Ludger, and that has to do with Brexit. Brexit will undoubtedly generate disruption to certain categories of financial transactions, especially since the exit agreement between the UK and the EU provided welcome clarity in a number of areas, notably trade, but has left a few loose ends as regards cross-border financial transactions. But I think it's important to realize that this disruption and the potential costs will affect both UK financial institutions and their EU-based clients. So there is an incentive on both sides to try to resolve the open issues as quickly as possible. Now, it seems, looking at the details a bit, that in banking and insurance there will be no problems. UK banks and insurance companies already have established EU subsidiaries and can service their clients from either jurisdiction. And the UK government has legislated to allow UK-based clients to continue using EU-based banks and financial institutions. One open area is in investment services. The EU has decided not to assess, so far, the equivalence of the UK's regulatory system to its own in the area of the markets for financial instruments regulations, a regulation connected to MiFID II. And that could create problems for EU-based clients using UK-based financial institutions for investment services. Another open issue is the uncleared OTC derivatives transactions. The UK has legislated to allow EU financial firms to perform life cycle events on such contracts with UK clients, but the European Commission has not yet reciprocated. And again, this could create problems for some EU-based clients. For OTC derivatives cleared through CCPs, on the other hand, there seems to be no problem because UK-based CCPs have been recognized by ESMA. Now, of course, the broader question, the more interesting question, is perhaps whether the City of London will be overshadowed by the emergence of another financial center in the EU. And here I must say I don't share the pessimism of many, including my former IMF colleagues. The position of the city as a global financial center is based on a number of deep-seated, long-standing structural factors, whether it's legal, regulatory, institutional, linguistic, cultural, what have you. All of these factors predate EU membership, and none of them are really affected by Brexit. And on top of that, you have economies of scale and agglomeration that have accumulated over decades. So, despite some disruption and possibly some loss of business, I expect the City of London to remain Europe's preeminent financial center, including for EU-based clients for the foreseeable future. Now, if you look several decades down the line, I don't know, in the distant future, of course, anything could happen. But I would not want to venture a prediction over such a time horizon.
Thank you, Dimitri. So there's still some hope for those of us in London to be able to continue buying German cars and French wine. Thank you both for these excellent remarks, for your time with us today. We've been able to cover a lot of ground on fiscal policy, on central banks, on the risks ahead, on Maastricht and the UK and Brexit. It's been great talking to you both. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.